Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
I am Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, an in-depth investigative report on fluoride. What are the real dangers? We have been led to believe up to this point that fluoride is a very important social health issue, that it helps prevent cavities, that's an essential nutrient for developing babies and young children, and that those who would criticize it are doing so from an unsupported pseudoscientific position, that the mainstream medical and scientific community, and certainly the entire dental community, believes without question or equivocation that without fluoridation, we would run an epidemic of dental caries or tooth decay in the United States, as well as osteoporosis. We're going to dissect each of these arguments in our program today. Normally, I would go to about 6 minutes of information on health and nutrition update. Not so today, because I want to be able to go into the discussion with Professor Paul Conant, C-O-N-N-E-T-T. He is professor of chemistry at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York. He has been in the chemistry department at St. Lawrence for 16 years, and he received his undergraduate degree from Cambridge University and his PhD at Dartmouth. He is not a paid consumer advocate, but has been fascinated and angered at the tremendous amount of misinformation surrounding the issue of fluoride. We'll speak with him first. Following that discussion, we will go to Bill Hersey, who is Senior Vice President for the EPA's National Treasury Employees Union Chapter 280. The union represents the scientists and professionals of the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, D.C. In 1962, Mr. Hersey received a Ph.D. in chemistry from the University of Missouri, and he's an expert in environmental management and risk assessment. He is also has experience in industrial research and environmental impact assessment at Monsanto. In addition, he has also taught chemistry at the University of Missouri in St. Louis and the American University in Washington, D.C. And finally, on today's program, special edition on fluoride, we'll talk with Dr. Harvey Limeback. He is head of preventive dentistry at the University of Toronto, and for 13 years he was the pro-fluoride expert and chief consultant to the Canadian Dental Association. However, it wasn't until he finally resigned from the Canadian Dental Association that he felt he could be critical of fluoride and be open and honest. It is rare that we have an opportunity to hear from someone who was the lead champion of a purpose such as fluoride, who now shows that those were not feelings that he should have had, and that he has been able to reassess his earlier positions and also tell us about the politics and political machinations that occur inside a public health group like the Dental Association of Canada, not so dissimilar, I would imagine, from the American Dental Association. Hence today's program, three highly qualified leading experts, all with advanced graduate degrees, all recognized because of their work and publications in peer-reviewed journals. I give you this simply because so often we are led to believe that the only people who would be critical of fluoride would be people who are misguided activists with no academic or intellectual capacity to understand the issues or the potential harm that they would bring upon the public by advocating the lessening or elimination of fluoride. Clearly, not the case. Let's go to our first guest and see if Dr. Paul Conant is standing by. Dr. Conant?
Hi, Gary. Yes, I'm here.
Thank you very much for being with us today. Did the issue of fluoride have its origins in our development of the atomic bomb?
No, I think that was part of the development. I think there was an opportunistic thing there. I think that maybe when they were developing the atomic bomb and realized they were going to have to use huge quantities of fluoride and produce huge quantities of fluoride waste, that having fluoride detoxified by having it in the drinking water was convenient for them, so that people didn't run around thinking that fluoride was a nasty, nasty substance. Remembering, of course, that prior to World War II, the main concern about fluoride was air pollution. Tremendous air pollution around facilities like superphosphate works, steel works, ceramic works, brick works, the aluminum industry. Lots and lots of fluoride pollution, which had damaged vegetation, damaged crops, damaged cattle. And there was a concern about that. There was a concern about what levels you could put into streams and rivers as your effluent. And at a time when people were talking, the waterworks people were actually talking about lowering fluoride to protect particularly children, because one of the things they knew before World War II was that fluoride caused dental fluorosis, mottling of the enamel. And so prior to World War II, they were talking about getting fluoride out of the drinking water, lowering the levels, and then all of a sudden you get this notion that at a certain level you have a minimum dental fluorosis and you have some protection against dental decay. I think the people involved in that, a lot of those people were genuinely interested in protecting teeth in those times. I'm talking about the 30s and the 40s, but I think there were opportunistic industries that saw a wonderful opportunity, one, to detoxify fluoride, make it the protected pollutant on the one hand, and secondly, the sugar industry that was looking for a magic bullet which would avoid reduction in sugar consumption. I think everybody knows that consumption of sugar causes dental decay. They are on record in 1950 as actually saying we need to find a way of reducing tooth decay without reducing sugar consumption. So I think you see opportunistic industries here using water fluoridation as a cover for what they really wanted to do. Keep selling sugar on the one hand and use massive amounts of fluoride on the other. Later on, of course, we also saw this extraordinary situation, which I'm sure Bill Hersey would talk about, with the superphosphate industry being able to get rid of its air pollution, that very same pollution which had damaged crops and cattle in the form of hexafluorosilicic acid and the sodium salt, these materials collected in the wet scrubbing systems of their industry to protect the air, and nobody wants to stop them doing that. But they then turn around and use this material to fluoridate the drinking water along with whatever contaminants are also in that material.
What evidence did they have at the time that they were promoting the continued use of sugar at its current very high consumption, but also allowing fluoride to be used, that fluoride may have been dangerous? And if you could tie that into the fluoride being a problem for the military and the exposure of fluoride to military personnel, did they have any reason to be concerned about any potential lawsuit for workers?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. During the Manhattan Project, people like Harold Hodge, who is one of the gurus of fluoride research, later emerged as one of the gurus of fluoride research, they were very concerned about the impacts of fluoride on the workers in the Manhattan Project, because there were a number of indications that it might lead to aberrations in behavior, and they were worried about what that would mean with workers dealing with very sensitive, dangerous material. And at that time, Harold Hodge asked to do a study to investigate the behavior of fluoride, the impact of fluoride on rat behavior. And first he got the go-ahead to do those experiments, and then later on he was told, if you've started that, stop it. If you haven't started it, don't start it. And apparently he had to wait nearly 50 years before he saw that experiment done in Boston in the 1990s by Phyllis Mullenix, where indeed she did show at that time that fluoride affected rat behavior. But obviously this was suspected at the time, for that experiment to be suggested. And of course, what was also very well known at that time is that fluoride damaged the bones. It accumulates in bones. There have been classic studies done by Roholm in Denmark, published in 1937, one of the most comprehensive and beautiful studies of fluoride ever achieved. And he clearly showed that fluoride damaged the bones of animals and human beings.
Tell us about Newburgh and Kingston, and tell us more about Dr. Howard Hodge. And also there were many Nobel Prize winners expressing opposition to fluoride because of its toxic properties on enzymes.
How does
fluoride interfere with hydrogen bonding and DNA and enzyme functions in a cell?
Okay, yes, very, very important, Gary. I'm glad you brought it up. First of all, some of the leading opponents of fluoridation in places like Wisconsin in the 40s and 50s were, in fact, biochemists. And precisely for the reason that you've mentioned, fluoride was known to interfere with the function of enzymes. And enzymes, as you know, but some of your listeners may not know, are biological catalysts. There are about 10,000 chemical reactions in the body, and each one of them is steered by a catalyst. And these catalysts are proteins. They're called enzymes. And fluoride is a very potent enzyme poison. So people like Nobel Prize winner James Sumner at Cornell University, who was one of the leading enzyme chemists of his time, he won the Nobel Prize for that research. He said, you know, be careful. This poison enzymes. You've got to be very careful about introducing this to the body. And in fact, in terms of Nobel Prize winners, the latest Nobel Prize winner from Sweden, who won it for physiology and medicine this year, Arvid Carlsson, was one of the leading opponents of fluoridation in Sweden. A successful campaign, incidentally, to stop them fluoridating in Sweden. And so, yes, it was well known, but the mechanisms were not well known. They just knew that if you threw fluoride into a test tube with an enzyme, the chances were strong. Even at one part per million, the enzyme wouldn't function properly. But how did it do it? Well, one notion was it interfered with magnesium, which is often used as a cofactor of many enzymes, and fluoride combined with the magnesium and stopped it doing what it should have been doing. So that's one thing. And the second thing is that was shown in 1981 that fluoride forms a very strong hydrogen bond with the amide function. That probably sounds like double dutch to many people, so let me explain that hydrogen bonding is at the very heart and soul of biochemistry. Proteins have their structure and their function revolving around hydrogen bonds. It's the Velcro strip of biology. It gives shape, and that shape can be easily manipulated with little energy involved. So these changes that enzymes catalyze usually are around hydrogen bonds. In addition, of course, the two strands of DNA are held together with hydrogen bonds. And DNA functions in its many different ways using hydrogen bonds. So when you find out that fluoride interferes with hydrogen bonds, you're striking at the very heart of biology. And it's a huge red flag to be extremely careful about introducing it to any living system. And, of course, we know that fluoride is highly poisonous to every living thing, insects, plants, animals, and, of course, human beings. The argument from the other side is that, but you're talking about high doses. We are talking one part per million in the drinking water. But what's emerging now in the 1990s or since the 1990s is a number of studies which are indicating that even at these supposedly low concentrations of one part per million, we are still able to interfere, the fluoride is able to interfere with critical biological functions.
Fluoride does not come to us alone as an isolated compound. We also get aluminum, one of the most abundant minerals in the Earth's surface. Explain to us that the synergy between aluminum and fluoride.
Yeah, that's another tricky one. Aluminum and fluoride form a number of complexes. And a complex is when you get a central metal ion, a positive ion, surrounded by a little coating of negative ions, and the one that seems to, there's a number of these aluminum fluoride complexes, but the one that seems to be pretty deadly is aluminum tetrafluoride, which the body sees like a phosphate ion, and it is capable of triggering G proteins, and G proteins is the system whereby a number of water-soluble messengers in the body, including hormones, neurotransmitters, and growth factors, get the signal from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell. A hormone, a chemical messenger, wants to change the chemistry inside the cell. Being water-soluble, it cannot cross the cell membrane, which is made of fat. So you have to have a system to get the messenger across. That's what the G proteins are for, and this aluminum tetrafluoride is capable of switching on those G proteins without the hormone present, without the neurotransmitter, without the growth factor or whatever messenger is involved. And that, again, is very striking. It's now used as a standard tool in biochemical research. If you're dealing with these messengers and you want to switch on that signal without the messenger present in your system, you just bung in aluminum fluoride and it does the trick. And what's of concern here is that we throw into our drinking water not only fluoride but aluminum. You use alum as a flocculating agent to bring down particulate immediately prior to adding the fluoride, so you have every possibility of forming these aluminum fluoride complexes. And so that is, I think, the most recent and most worrying aspect of fluoride subtle biochemistry.
Let's take a look also at fluoride causing hormonal disruption and perhaps causing many girls to reach puberty too early.
Yes, this is a very, very close to my heart, because I've met the researcher who's done this work now four times. That's Jennifer Luke, who got her PhD thesis looking at the pineal gland. And I wonder how many doctors and regulatory authorities that have promoted fluoridation for the last 55 years had any idea that fluoride would impact the pineal gland. This is a little gland. It's in the center of the brain between the two hemispheres. The ancients called it the seat of the soul. It's not protected by the blood-brain barrier. It has a very high perfusion rate of blood, second only to the kidney, and it is also a calcifying tissue. It lays down exactly the same crystals of calcium hydroxyapatite that you get in the teeth and the bones. And what Luke said was, oh my goodness, this gland is going to attract fluoride like a magnet. So she looked at 11 corpses in England, and sure enough, she found huge levels of fluoride on these crystals, averaging 9,000 parts per million, going up to 21,000 parts per million in a couple of cases. Then she looked at animals. She looked at Mongolian gerbils, and what she found was the animals treated with fluoride had a lower production of melatonin, which is a hormone. It's produced only at night, the hormone of darkness. It's involved with a number of things, hibernation in animals, sleep, hibernation, I've mentioned, jet lag. And it is thought also to be the biological time clock for the onset of puberty. Children produce a lot of melatonin in these dark cycles, and as that level drops, so puberty comes on earlier. And she indeed found in her animal studies lower levels of melatonin being produced and earlier onset of puberty. And of course, it raises the question of the early puberty that we're now seeing in this country at an alarming levels. Does fluoride contribute to that? There are probably a number of contributing factors, but fluoride might be one. And you mentioned Newburgh and Kingston earlier on. Of course, that was overseen by the Manhattan Project. They followed the health effects of the children, and there were a couple of findings which they didn't think were significant at the time, but we now think could have been extremely significant. One of them was that the girls in fluoridated Newburgh were reaching menstruation 5 months earlier on average than the girls in Kingston. And the second finding was an increase in cortical bone defects amongst particularly the boys in that area, which prompted people to suggest we should look to see at osteosarcoma rates in young men. And indeed, when they finally got around to doing that, some 35, that suggestion was made in 55. It was followed up by the National Academy of Sciences in 1977. They finally looked for these things in the late 80s, early 90s. They found an increase in osteosarcoma in male rats, not female rats, and they found two epidemiological studies found an increase in osteosarcoma in young men. And other studies have not found it. Throughout this business with fluoride, it's always complicated. For every study you find which shows an effect, someone will find a study which doesn't show an effect, and then some people use that to nullify, to concern, and fluoridation continues.
What about fluoride's influence on the central nervous system?
Well, that's going back to Howard Hodge, who first suggested we look at that, and he never did, or supposedly didn't publish it if he did look at it. Phyllis Mullinex looked at that at Forsyth Dental Center. She was the head of the toxicology department there, and in 1995 she published a paper which showed that rats exposed to fluoride before they were born were hyperactive, and those after they were born exposed, that they were hypoactive couch potato. She was criticized for using high levels of fluoride, but it's interesting that Isaacson's group at the SUNY Binghamton, they've looked at rats treated with one part per million, and going back to your question about aluminum, they looked not only at sodium fluoride, but they looked at aluminum fluoride as well. And in these rats, treated for 2 years at one part per million, they found kidney damage, brain damage, and an increased uptake of aluminum into the brain. And so that's another area of concern. The other area, that's just animals. Okay, what about human beings? There have been now three studies from China which indicate a decrease in IQ as a function of fluoride exposure. Now, what's interesting about that Chinese stuff is it may be exposure to fluoride with iodide deficiency. In other words, fluoride might be a really devastating, even at levels less than one part per million, if the child also has a shortage of iodide. So there's still a lot of questions about the IQ stuff in from China. But as Dr. Hardy Lineback, I'm sure, will talk about, the benefits that we are pursuing here, the most comprehensive study done in the United States shows a 0.6 tooth surface difference in terms of dental decay, a 0.6 tooth surface difference between children in non-fluoridated and fluoridated communities in the United States. And that's a 0.6 tooth surface out of 128 tooth surfaces. So we're looking at a minute gain, if it exists at all, with water fluoridation, and we have to offset that against these studies which are looking at the impacts on puberty, on the central nervous system, on our bones with hip fracture and osteoarthritis, all these other concerns.
Well, how about also on the thyroid gland?
Oh, absolutely. Well, that comes back to this iodide business. For, you know, early studies, they used to use, there were a couple of physiologists, doctors, who were using fluoride to treat hyperthyroidism, an overactive thyroid. So it's known for a long time in the medical literature that fluoride decreased the activity of the thyroid gland. So you have to wonder if what happens when somebody is hypothyroid, when they've got an underactive thyroid gland, what happens to them when they get exposed to fluoride? And that's another issue, hyperthyroidism. I think one of the biggest selling medications in this country is a drug used to treat hypothyroidism. It's a huge problem, particularly for women in this country.
Let's, by the way, I appreciate the information you're giving us. Let's talk about parts of the world that have rejected water fluoridation, and do they have a strong scientific basis for doing so?
Well, I think that's very important. You know, apropos your comment at the beginning, Gary, when you said that we are not nutcases, you know, the debate in this country has been controlled politically. It hasn't been won scientifically. It's been controlled politically. It's been controlled politically by waiving all these authorities that are supposed to endorse fluoridation on the one hand, and also castigating the opponents of fluoridation as being a bunch of flat-earth nutcases. And I certainly am not one of those, and most of the people that I've met since I've been involved in this for 5 years are very level-headed and rational people. Having said all that, what was the question again?
The question is, what countries in the world
Oh, yes. Okay.
have rejected it, because they must have some sound science and very very level-headed, also people absolutely. Coming forward.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, most countries in Europe do not fluoridate. The only countries that fluoridate in Europe are Ireland, at 63% of their people drink fluoridated water. That's mandated. The major political party, the second largest political party in Ireland, has announced that it will reject fluoridation if it's elected into office. So that's beginning to crumble. The UK at 10%, and I think Spain may be 3 or 4%, and some isolated communities in Switzerland may have fluoridation. The rest, some have dabbled with it, but they've all now rejected it, all the rest. That includes the whole of Scandinavia. Big, big debate in Sweden that was eventually won against fluoridation. Big, big debate in Holland. They dabble with it, and it was stopped. Germany hardly ever did it, and when the two Germanys reunited, even East Germany dropped fluoridation. So the overwhelming Western European countries have rejected fluoridation, and that tells you something. I mean, what you're talking about there isn't just citizens. You're talking about German scientists, Dutch scientists, Swedish scientists. You're talking about regulatory agencies, health agencies. They've looked at this, and they've rejected it on two grounds, right? The precautionary principle, if in doubt, leave it out. There's too many unknowns. There's too many questions that haven't been resolved. Let's err on the side of safety on the one hand. And also, I think, despite our claims to be so democratic, I think they're more sensitive to the will of the people and not wishing to impose on a minority. Even when a majority wants fluoridation, what right have we to impose it on individuals that don't want it? I mean, this is medication. This is not nutrition. This is medication.
Okay, then if that's the case, if it's a medication, drugs should have a safety margin of 100 times their therapeutic dose.
Yes.
Is there any margin of safety factored in for communities that fluoridated their water?
No, there's no margin of safety because you cannot control the dose. The maximum safety margin that I can see in the literature for bone damage, it at most is 4. At most is 4. And it's probably much closer we got 10 studies which show an association between fluoridation and hip fracture. And there we're talking 1 part per million, 2 parts per million. So as far as hip fracture is concerned, there is practically no safety margin. There is no safety margin for dental fluorosis. And of course, you've got to take into account when you expose a whole population, you've got people there that are going to be super vulnerable, super sensitive, and you're going to have people that are going to get much higher doses. That's why you need a factor of 100. You need a factor of 10 to take into account the different doses that people are going to have. You know, some people drink a terrific amount of water. And you also need a factor of 10 for the range of sensitivities that you're going to have in any human population. You look at any human trait, and it goes through a normal distribution. And what I'm particularly concerned about is the tail of that normal distribution, the people that are super sensitive, the people who've already got a weakened immune system, the people who already have kidney problems, the people who are already diabetics. All these people are going to be super sensitive to fluoride. And yet we are exposing everybody willy-nilly, and we can't control the dose, and we're not letting them have informed consent. I mean, the whole thing is outrageous. It's Kafka. I can't work out if Kafka wrote this play or George Orwell, quite frankly.
Is it safe to swallow fluoride toothpaste?
No. There's a study by Pendris. Again, Hardy Lineback is the person that can tell you more on this. There's a study by Pendris just a few years ago which indicates that a child brushing their teeth twice a day with fluoridated toothpaste will get more dental fluorosis than a child brushing their teeth once a day. Unfortunately, number one, people are encouraged to put too much toothpaste on the brush, and I think the toothpaste manufacturers have been utterly irresponsible on this because they still advertise this toothpaste with these giant curls on the brush when you're supposed to be putting just a dab of toothpaste on. And secondly, young children cannot control the swallowing reflex, and so inevitably they swallow some of the fluoride. There is another issue which was demonstrated by Shashila in India, and that is that fluoride can go through the gums. So even if you spit it all out, some fluoride will go through your gums. And so that's why a number of opponents now of fluoride, even though it's attractive to say, look, if you want fluoride, brush your teeth with fluoridated toothpaste, and that makes more sense since the benefits are now accepted to be topical, not systemic. So maximize the benefits by applying it topically and spit it out to minimize your systemic exposure through swallowing, which is inevitable, of course, if you put it into the water. So it's very attractive for us to say, look, if you want fluoride, use fluoridated toothpaste, don't put it in the water. But there are other people who are very annoyed by that because they say, that sounds to me that you're advocating fluoridated toothpaste. Personally, I'm very attracted to what they're doing in Finland and Scandinavia, which is using xylitol in toothpaste. Xylitol is a natural product that is extracted from pine bark, and that seems to also deal with the bacteria in the mouth which cause tooth decay with sugar. So if I was going to take a gamble with my children, that's what I would use. Our family uses non-fluoridated toothpaste.
You mentioned earlier that there was an association between osteoporosis and fluoride. Could you expand on that? And if it's true that children are consuming, and I'm sure some adults too will swallow down some fluoride, what percentage of that fluoride that they're swallowing, even in mouthwashes, will go to the bones and hence could precipitate osteoporosis?
Well, they estimate that approximately 50% of the fluoride that we ingest each day is excreted through the kidney. And the remainder, which is approximately 50%, goes into the bones. And it steadily accumulates in the bones over a lifetime. There is some concern about brittle bones in children. There seems to be some indication that children with dental fluorosis also have weaker bones. That study, that's work that hasn't been published yet. I'm expecting that to be published shortly. But the more definite concern right now is the increase in hip fracture in the elderly. As I said, there have been 18 studies since 1990 on this issue, and 10 of them show an association with increased hip fracture and fluoride in the water. And one study in particular from China shows almost a dose response increase in hip fracture as the level of fluoride goes up. So it doubles at around 2 parts per million and triples over 4 parts per million. And you know, with a chemical, a toxic chemical, usually toxicologists like to do high-dose experiments with animals. But in the case of this area of bone fracture, they've done high-dose experiments with human beings because they have used fluoride, and they've done this since about the 1960s, in an effort to correct osteoporosis. You know, osteoporosis is the loss of bone mineral density, the loss of calcium. It makes the bones more porous and more prone to break. So the idea was you gave people sodium fluoride tablets, anything from 20 to 80 milligrams of fluoride per day, in an effort to harden those bones and prevent these fractures. Well, it does harden the bones. It does increase the bone mineral density, but it was also found to increase the hip fracture rates because it makes the bones more brittle and more prone, particularly the bones which experience torsional stress, like the wrist and the hip, which is the most worrying of all. It increased hip fracture. So we have the high-dose experiment, and we've got some evidence that even the low doses of 1 part per million contribute to these hip fractures. And I know some people, when they hear about bone fractures, they say, ho-hum, you know, I've had fractures. I'm sure you have, Gary. I mean, I've had bone breaks in my hand, in my leg, in my arm. And, you know, it's a few weeks in plaster, and eventually everything's back to normal. This isn't the case with hip fracture. Hip fracture in the elderly is literally deadly. 25%, 1 in 4 elderly people that have a hip fracture are dead within a year of that operation. It requires total immobilization, And people just do not survive this. And 50% never regain independent existence that have a hip fracture. And it costs the United States about $10 billion. So anything that contributes to hip fracture in this country is very, very serious indeed.
Last question for you. The U.S. Public Health Service, or anyone else that is responsible for the fluoridation of our water supplies, have they ever done any long-term studies to see what effect this might have upon the population using it?
Not really. Not what I would call good science. I mean, the thing which is glaringly missing here, I mean, having said, and I don't think there are many people that disagree, that 50% of the fluoride that you ingest goes into your bones, wouldn't you think that the obvious thing for the U.S. Public Health Service to have done over the last 55 years was to track the fluoride levels in our bones as a function of how many years we live in fluoridated communities? You know, when people die or when people have bones removed for whatever reason, little chip of bone, they could have been, we could have millions of data points now for when, how much fluoride you expect in your bones if you lived in a fluoridated area for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. We could have looked at it as a function of diet, as a function of lifestyle, as a function of disease status, and all these things. We've got practically no bone data. Very, very little indeed. And I think that's absolutely shocking.
I would look at it from a slightly different perspective. I would not look at it solely from the calcification or brittleness. I would look at the fact that much of our immune system, our B cells, are created in bone marrow.
Oh, yes.
And if fluoride is an enzyme inhibitor,
yes,
and if enzymes are necessary for the production of those B cells, as they are, then is it possible that anyone's immune dysfunction, making them more susceptible to present endogenous and exogenous viruses and bacteria, could be related directly and indirectly to some lessening or incapacitation of the immune system to be completely formulated on their behalf in full force, and they don't have that because they've been drinking fluoride, which has affected the enzymes, which affects the B cells, which affects the immune system?
Well, I think these are very, very rational deductions. I'm not an expert on the immune system. I have not studied that aspect of the literature. But I think it's another area which has to be looked at very, very carefully. And, of course, what it does mean, Gary, is that when people are looking at various health effects, this is going to be a difficult one to tease out, because the health effect that you see because of a weakened immune system may not point you in the direction of fluoride. You may not know that it's fluoride that contributed to the weakening of the immune system because of this increase in this particular disease. In the same way with cancer, there may be many cancers today which are happening because of fluoride being a promoter of cancer, interfering with the DNA repair mechanism, the enzymes which are involved in DNA repair. So sometimes, you know, the proponents of fluoride poo-poo the number of diseases which people point to as being possibly associated with fluoride. But that's precisely what you would expect if you have a chemical which has such a broad spectrum impact. I mean, impacting enzymes, impacting hydrogen bonds, impacting DNA repair, impacting, as you've talked about, various aspects of the immune system. And yes, the very fact that the fluoride is concentrating in an area of the body so close to the genesis of the immune system, the bone marrow, is of real concern. And again, let's go back to osteosarcoma. Why does that strike young men? And it's probably because this is for young men, this is a period of rapid bone growth. If rapid DNA replication, if there's a little bit of fluoride around when you get this rapid replication, that's a very rational explanation of why fluoride might contribute to an increase in osteosarcoma.
Let us not also forget that the pineal gland that you mentioned earlier, where the woman got her PhD in, in the studies, pineal gland is where we secrete and create melatonin, and that is our number one antioxidant for the brain, and it's a major immune modulator. Hence, people who have insomnia who don't secrete melatonin frequently also have defects in their immune system. And glutathione, glutathione peroxidase, and superoxide dismutase and catalase all are important for protecting the brain.
Yes.
If these are these are negatively affected by fluoride, and it does negatively affect the pineal gland, then I think we should be doing some research to study what its potential on melatonin production is.
Absolutely, and also don't forget that there are four steps between tryptophan and melatonin in the pineal gland. The first two steps produce from tryptophan serotonin. Another incredibly important chemical is a neurotransmitter in the brain. And so we get possibly the impact on that as well. You know, it's very difficult in such a short time, Gary, to go through all the details. If listeners are interested, we do. My son has got a web page called, address is www.fluoridealert.org, and I know you have yourself, if you have a wonderful web page, and I want to take my hat off to you, Gary. You got into this issue long before I did. I've only been involved for 5 years, and I was particularly impressed with your summation of the issue, which you can find on your own web page. So I thank you for keeping your listeners informed. When did you get involved?
My first article I wrote on fluoride in 1968.
Oh my goodness.
And I've done about, but again, no one was willing to listen back then.
Yeah.
And over the years, I had Dr. Dean Burke on.
Yes.
At the National Academy of National Cancer Institute, head of cytotoxicology. Nobody cared.
Yeah.
And so, but now I believe is the time when we're all more receptive to the messages. And so let's mention again, www.fluoridealert.org.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for being on.
Well, thank you, Gary.
That is Dr. Paul Connett, C-O-N-N-E-T-T. He is professor of chemistry, St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York, and graduate of Cambridge University, PhD at Dartmouth. Let's now go over and say hello to our next panelist. He is Bill Frizzy, F-I-R-Z-Y. Is Senior Vice President for the EPA's National Treasury Employees Union, Chapter 280, the union representing the scientists and professionals at the EPA. He received his PhD in chemistry from the University of Missouri. He's an expert in environmental management and risk assessment. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be with you. Actually, my name is spelled H-I-R-Z-Y, Herzy.
I'm sorry, Herzy.
Okay.
Let's talk about what is the FDA union's current policy on fluoride and the scientific basis of that position?
Actually, our union represents the scientists at EPA, and I can tell you about that. our union voted in 1997 to join the Citizens for Safe Drinking Water initiative out in California to keep fluoride out of the drinking water system in California. And subsequent to that action, we've endorsed similar measures around the country. So we've basically taken a look at the risks that fluoride in the drinking water poses and come to the conclusion that this is bad public policy.
Why is it that it's still being offered, and if it is bad public policy?
Well, there's this governmental inertia, which having begun back in the middle 1940s of these experiments, to get the government to admit that it's done something wrong is very difficult, and that's basically where we are with regard to this fluoridation issue. I mean, people are have been singing this mantra, safe and effective, for over 50 years, and they find themselves basically riding a tiger and find it very difficult to get off that.
If you were to summarize what you know to be the toxic effects of fluoride, even as a neurotoxin, what would they be?
Well, neurotoxicity, of course, is the issue that's come up most recently to our attention. But bone pathology is another major concern. And as Paul Connett has pointed out, the ability of fluoride to interrupt hydrogen bonding in proteins has implications for all sorts of toxic effects in the body. The neurotoxicity may well be mediated by this kind of effect, the bone pathology as well. Those are the major concerns, and I think, as you earlier mentioned, that there may be implications for the immune system, given the high concentration of fluoride in the bone where B cells are produced. I think the impact, the cascade type impact that fluoride may have through the immune system on other kinds of pathology in the body are quite disturbing. There's really it's very difficult to predict, I think, as you and Paul Conant were discussing, exactly where that might end. A number of disease processes are impacted by the body's ability to fight off pathogens, and it's quite plausible. I think the hypothesis that you put forward is quite plausible, that fluoride may be adversely affecting the immune system too.
Has official EPA policy actually been to promote or challenge the disposal of industrial waste like fluoride into the public water supply?
Well, we have a letter which is quite disturbing that goes back to 1983 and have not seen any revocation of that. The letter was written by the Deputy Assistant Administrator for the Office of Water in response to a question from a citizen about hydroflow silicic acid, which is used in over 90% of the fluoridation systems in the United States, either as the acid or its sodium salt. And in that letter, the Deputy Assistant Administrator says, in effect, that the EPA considers it an ideal solution to a long-standing environmental problem that the phosphate fertilizer industry captures this off-gas, hydroflow silicic acid, which would otherwise be an air pollutant or a water pollutant, and thereby, by capturing it, provides a low-cost source of fluoride for water authorities. We have no indication that EPA has come off of that position, which, when you step back and look at that, it's a staggering statement of public policy. This material, which, if it comes out the smokestack, is an air pollutant, or if it goes out in the drain pipe down into the river, is a water pollutant, is magically converted into some sort of beneficial agent if you put it in a tank wagon and then go bleed it into your drinking water systems. I mean, it's a remarkable transformation, and really scary.
Where does the fluoride come from, and does it contain any toxic byproducts?
My understanding is from recent information coming out of the Centers for Disease Control is that all the fluoridation chemicals in the United States, including sodium fluoride, which is used in 10% or less of the systems, all of that comes from the phosphate fertilizer manufacturing industry as byproducts. And, of course, in any kind of capture of a byproduct like that, you're going to have contaminants present. And the contaminants are going to vary based on the source of the phosphate rock that's being processed and the particular processing conditions. So a couple of the analytical data sheets that I've seen show levels of chromium, arsenic, some lead. So there are going to be those toxic substances. And one of the things that is another interesting policy question is that EPA sets at least two different kinds of water quality standards. One called maximum contaminant level goal, which is a science-based goal, to which one tries to adhere as closely as possible. The other is the maximum contaminant level, which is the a level that's set as close to the maximum contaminant level goal as possible, depending on economics and other sort of feasibility questions. The point is that the maximum contaminant level goal, what we should be shooting for both arsenic and lead, is zero. We would love to have water supplies with zero lead, zero arsenic in. And yet EPA is encouraging the use of hydroflow silicic acid, which definitely adds both of those elements to drinking water systems. Now, that's
a contradiction.
That's exactly right. It's something for people to chew on.
Well, I appreciate you being on and sharing your insights. I'm sorry we don't have more time, but I still want to have one more guest on, Dr. Harvey Limeback. So thank you very much for your good work and speaking up on behalf of the scientists at the Environmental Protection Agency who are concerned about fluoride and giving us these facts from the inside.
My pleasure to be on, Gary. Keep up your good work as well.
Thank you. That was Dr. Bill Hersey. Let's go over now and say hello to our final panelist, Dr. Harvey Limeback. Dr. Harvey Limeback is head of preventive dentistry at the University of Toronto, and for 13 years he was the fluoride expert and consultant to the Canadian Dental Association. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Limeback.
Hi.
Dr. Limeback, why did you decide to change your position and speak out against fluoride after many years as an advocate?
Well, actually, Dr. Hersey was mentioning one of the main reasons why I was quite upset about this whole issue about water fluoridation, this issue of adding contaminants to our water supply. It just didn't make any sense at all to be putting this kind of phosphate fertilizer byproduct into our water supply, especially since we have recently discovered, actually over the last 10 years of research, that fluoride doesn't work by swallowing it. It only works, and only to a marginal extent these days, possibly not at all. It only works by coming in contact with the teeth after the teeth come through the gum tissue. And then recently a whole bunch of water fluoridation studies have shown that we are already at maximum levels of protection against dental decay in North America from all kinds of other sources of fluoride and for all kinds of other reasons, such as better diets and better attention to hygiene and antibiotics and preservatives in the foods and all kinds of other reasons. Basically, the dental decay rates in North America are so low that water fluoridation provides little to no benefit whatsoever these days. In fact, there have been some studies to show that when you turn the taps off, the water fluoridation taps, you turn them off and look for dental decay rates, they don't move whatsoever. There is no increase in dental decay when you stop fluoridating. But what you do see is a decrease in the dental fluorosis. So we're actually causing more fluorosis, dental fluorosis, from all the water fluoridation these days than is necessary.
What are some of the other problems associated with fluoride ingestion?
Well, one of the main problems that I've been doing research on is the problem of accumulation of fluoride in the bone. We're quite concerned, actually, that fluoride accumulates through a lifetime of water fluoridation and causes the bone to become more brittle. We've started a study, and we're almost completed it, close to publishing it, that we have shown people that have been exposed to just 20 to 30 years of water fluoridation have twice the amount of fluoride in their bones. And now there are all kinds of epidemiological studies to show that people who live in fluoridated areas have a higher risk for hip fractures or other kinds of fractures, such as forearm fractures when they fall down. So this is quite a concern. I personally don't think we need to be ingesting fluoride to protect our kids' teeth, because they're already protected at a maximum. And, you know, the rest of us are swallowing all this fluoride from the drinking water and possibly increasing the risk for bone fracture. It just doesn't make sense at all.
Isn't it also true that we receive fluoride from other sources other than just drinking water?
Well, of course, yeah. With the widespread use of fluoridated toothpaste, a small percentage of our fluoride exposure is from toothpaste that we can't avoid. When we use toothpaste, a certain amount of that stays inside the mouth, even when we rinse properly. And some of that is ingested and of course, accumulates in our skeletal system. But that, compared to the fluoridated water, is actually quite small. Fluoridated water provides at least two-thirds of your daily fluoride intake. When you consider all of the other beverages that are made with fluoridated water, when you consider you're cooking with fluoridated water, and the fluoride gets incorporated into your foods, etc. And there are many other natural sources, such as tea. Tea will take up fluoride from the soil and concentrate it in its leaves, and that natural fluoride in tea obviously gets ingested on top of the stuff that you ingest that is artificially fluoridated.
Another phenomenon I'm seeing is that some manufacturers of toothpastes are beginning to put warning labels on the packages of toothpaste saying not to swallow the toothpaste, yet up to 60% of toothpaste is invariably in children susceptible to being at some small amount ingested.
Oh, their own studies even show that kids anywhere up to age 6 cannot avoid swallowing it. These studies are at least 30 or 40 years old. Their own studies have shown that if you start toothbrushing at age 3 or 4, kids will swallow up to 60% of the toothpaste you put in their mouth. The warning label is there, I think, personally, in my opinion, the warning label is there to get them off the hook in the next 10 years. It takes about 12 years for them to get off the hook in terms of legal responsibility. People that have been basically exposed to too much fluoride ingestion when the toothpaste were not labeled with warning labels have a case against the toothpaste companies. They weren't told that ingesting fluoride would cause an increase in dental fluorosis. They weren't told that possibly a lifetime accumulation of fluoride ingestion may be harmful. And therefore, they have a good case against the toothpaste companies.
Have you been under any pressure whatsoever from any groups or individuals not to speak out?
Oh, of course. I've been berated by my colleagues. I've been, coaxed to not be so vocal. Of course, I can't avoid requests to speak out on radio programs and in the media. Ever since a Toronto newspaper article came out quoting my opposition to fluoridation, it's been pretty difficult to avoid the media. And of course, the more people hear about this, the more they're quite concerned about it. And and dentists are concerned that they have to talk to their patients about this issue, and they're not well informed about it. And of course, they're quite upset that I'm against putting fluoride in the water supply, and they have to explain it to their patients. So the university here is getting quite a number of upset emails and phone calls, and the dean has actually been, he's been supportive, but on the other hand, they don't like all this attention.
I could certainly appreciate why. I'm sorry that we do not have more time. I will like to establish an interview with you to continue this discussion. There's many more questions I have for you pertaining to the research on this, but I do want to thank you, Dr. Harvey Lineback, for taking this time to share with us today.
You're quite welcome.
We're out of time. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank all of you for listening today. If you'd like a tape of today's show, call 888-317-2346 and ask for program number 20.